From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the LA riots, after Gregory Allen Williams walked into an angry mob to rescue a Japanese-American man who was beaten unconscious, he was the second person Williams had saved that day. On today's Fresh Air, Williams tells us why he intervened and how, as an African-American, it affected his understanding of race in America. Also today, a politically incorrect novel about slavery. We talk with Carol Phillips, author of Crossing the River, about how some people were both victims and perpetrators of the slave trade. Phillips is of African descent, born in the West Indies and raised in London. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead fills in for film critic Stephen Schiff. He reviews the new comedy, I'll Do Anything. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. During the LA riots, actor Gregory Allen Williams walked into an angry mob to rescue a Japanese-American man who was beaten unconscious. He was the second person Williams had saved that day. On today's Fresh Air, Williams tells us why he intervened and how, as an African-American, it affected his understanding of race in America. Also, a politically incorrect novel about slavery. We talk with Carol Phillips, author of Crossing the River, about how some people were both victims and perpetrators of the slave trade. Phillips is of African descent, born in the West Indies and raised in London. And Kevin Whitehead, filling in for film critic Stephen Schiff, reviews the new comedy I'll Do Anything. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says the Congressional Budget Office's report on his health care reform plan is a Washington policy wonk deal. The CBO says the president's plan would add more than $70 billion to the federal deficit over the next 6 years. The White House had claimed the plan would cut the deficit. Mr. Clinton says no serious person in the real world will worry about the CBO report. It recommends the president's mandatory premiums should be included in the federal budget. Republicans say the premiums should be called taxes. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen is trying to win support on Capitol Hill for the president's budget package. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports he's run into opposition from conservative Republicans.
Lloyd Bentsen told the House Budget Committee the new budget contains some tough spending cuts, including the elimination of 115 different programs. But the senior Republican on the panel, John Kasich, told Bentsen the administration had missed an opportunity to really shrink the size of the deficit.
Why do you fight every effort that we make up here to cut spending, especially when we have a chance to win?
God, we obviously are not fighting every effort to cut spending, and obviously so that we need some of those cuts for health reform to be able to put that one through. These deficits will begin to increase again after 96 if we don't bring that one about.
The administration also faces opposition from some liberal Democrats who are upset with cuts in areas such as public housing and job training for low-income teens. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The hardline leader of the Bosnian Croats has resigned. Mate Boban was president of the Croats' self-proclaimed state within Bosnia. His decision to step down comes as the Bosnian Muslim Croat alliance has collapsed. Richard Carruthers filed this report for the BBC.
Mr. Boban's resignation was no surprise. He's not represented Bosnian Croats at peace talks for a month and was under pressure from the government of Croatia to step down. Mr. Boban served as the chief architect of the Croatian mini-state in southwestern Bosnia-Herzegovina. Zagreb has never denied arming and financing the Bosnian Croat militia. Recent reports, though, that regular Croatian army troops are fighting in Bosnia have prompted United Nations threats of punitive economic measures, and now European Union foreign ministers have called for Croatian soldiers to withdraw. Although Zagreb maintains it wants improved Muslim-Croat relations, Mr. Boban's resignation may not represent a change in policy. A political commentator here says Mr. Boban has done President Tudjman's dirty work. His sacrifice now is a public relations exercise for international consumption.
Richard Carruthers reporting for the BBC from Zagreb. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost a point at 3,907. Trading is heavy on volume of 308 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 3 at 782. This is NPR. A military judge has dismissed charges against three Navy flyers in the Tailhook sexual abuse scandal. Now the Navy has to start from the beginning if it's going to pursue the cases. The three flyers were accused of misconduct at the 1991 Tailhook Convention in Las Vegas. Dozens of women say they were sexually abused or harassed there. The judge says the evidence shows, quote, unlawful command influence in the prosecution. The flyers argued Admiral Frank Kelso has a conflict of interest. They say Kelso, the chief of naval operations, was in a position to see misconduct at the convention. Therefore, he should not have appointed the chief Tailhook investigator. Canada is acting to stop cigarette smuggling. Prime Minister Jean Chrétien says he will lower taxes on tobacco products and increase anti-smuggling efforts. John Hauber reports from Toronto.
For the last 4 years, tobacco smuggling has been on the rise in Canada. It is now estimated that in the province of Quebec alone, almost two-thirds of cigarettes sold are smuggled. Today, following weeks of pressure to address the problem by opposition parties, the Liberal government of Prime Minister Jean Chrétien announced tough new policies to deal with the smuggling crisis. They include a lower tax on cigarette sales to discourage smugglers and new orders to the Canadian police to step up border security. But in the last few days, a note of warning has been sounded by Canada's natives. Most cigarettes are smuggled into Canada by Indians, whose reserves straddle the border with the United States. Mohawk leaders in Ontario and Quebec have already said that if the police try to stop smuggling within the reserves, force will be met with force. For National Public Radio, this is John Halber in Toronto.
A private business group says low mortgage rates helped a lot of people buy new homes last year. The National Association of Realtors says home prices increased at the end of last year since so many people were buying. The real estate group says prices rose 3.4% nationally in the fourth quarter. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gregory Allen Williams, rescued two people from their attackers during the riots that followed the Rodney King verdict. In his new memoir, A Gathering of Heroes, Allen Williams writes about why he intervened and how, as an African American, it affected his thoughts on race in America. Gregory Allen Williams is an actor, a star of the popular series Baywatch, and he played a Secret Service agent in the Line of Fire. He was on his way home from the gym when he heard that a truck driver had been attacked at the intersection of Florence and Normandy. So he drove there, hoping to be one of the people that could quiet things down. On his way, he saw a group of teenagers chasing a man down the street. When Allen Williams hollered, "Leave him alone," the attackers ran. Then Allen Williams parked his car and walked to the intersection of Florence and Normandy, where he saw Takao Hirato, a Japanese-American man, being beaten unconscious in his car.
A brown Ford Bronco had pulled to a stop, and when the light changed, began moving through the intersection. As it did so, projectiles came from every corner and broke many of the windows. Several people dashed out from the corners and began beating the driver inside his vehicle. Within a few seconds, the driver slumped forward unconscious and was driven backwards by a blow to the head. At that point, I moved from the, it would have been the southwest corner, and out to the vehicle and stepped up to the car. And there was a fellow who was about to hit him with a bottle. And I said, "Come on, y'all know this ain't right." And the young man who had the bottle, just for a moment, the bottle dropped to his side, and that gave me sort of enough time to slip in between that fellow and another fellow who had begun opening the door, I assume, so they could pull Mr. Hirata from the vehicle. But I stepped in front of them and grabbed an unconscious Takao Hirata and pulled him out of the vehicle. But even as I did so, someone struck him from the passenger side, and once we were, maybe 2 or 3 yards from the vehicle, someone else smashed a bottle across his face.
You thought that was a really cowardly act, to smash a bottle across the face of a man who was already unconscious.
I did. It made me very angry, particularly in the wake of the riots, having been called an uprising, a revolution. I didn't think that that was a way of a warrior, an avenger of the race, to run up and strike a man who was unconscious and unable to defend himself.
Once you got Mr. Hirato out of his car, you had to figure out how to get him away from the intersection. How did you get him out?
Pulled him to the sidewalk and asked him if he could walk, and he shook his head no, and I took that. I didn't know at the time that he was delirious and really hadn't understood what I said, but I told him, "You're going to have to walk or you're going to die." He looked at me And I began pulling him to his feet, and he put his feet under him, and we got him to his feet, and we began moving down the sidewalk, and we moved a couple of blocks, and he would lose consciousness now and then. Finally, an African-American man in a van came along and took him to Metropolitan Medical Center in downtown Los Angeles.
Well, I want to hear more about the personal reasons why you did what you did. And in your book, for instance, you write about how you understood a lot about the rage that was being expressed on the streets after the Rodney King verdict, because you grew up really angry yourself.
Yeah, I had an attitude, a lot of attitude. I understand what it is to be overlooked in America, and many peoples and individuals have been overlooked for various reasons. I know what it is to wall yourself off from other people to lessen the pain. Anger at a very early age, at about 8 years old, became my friend. It was a comfort to me.
What was the anger coming from?
Well, from one growing up in a predominantly, in a Eurocentric community, in a Eurocentric school system, in Iowa, not with bad people, but with people who focused on their own culture and their own offspring, as well as people do. Of course, I came up in a time when I was told that my rage was justifiable and healthy. I remember not only in the African-American community, but in the European-American community, I can remember well, quote-unquote, liberal white people interviewing Huey and Bobby and saying, tell us about your rage, and just shuddering with excitement and hearing about the black man's rage. And so I came up believing that it was my birthright and a requisite to revolution and social change.
So you understood rage, and you also felt that you understood what it was like to be beaten up and what it was like to be an attacker, that you understood both parts of that.
I understood what it was to be a perpetrator of violence. I understood what it was to be a victim of violence. I understood what it was to be a bystander.
When were you a victim?
There was an incident in seventh grade when I had transferred to a predominantly white junior high school because I wasn't an athlete. I had been going to a predominantly black junior high, and I wasn't an athlete and that sort of thing. And in my neighborhood, if you weren't an athlete, if you were a musician and writer, whatnot, then you weren't hip, you weren't cool, you weren't really black. So I said, well, I'll go over and be with the white folks because they're reasonable and civilized. So I went. And after a few months there, I was coming out of band practice one day in the auditorium, and a high schooler from a school about 10 miles away, huge guy, hit me at the auditorium door. Just as I got to the door, I didn't even see it coming, and he shattered my lip. And many of my fellow students laughed, and I was stumbling around, bleeding from the mouth, and that sort of thing. And when I was suspended from school, and
you were suspended.
I was suspended from school. And a couple of days later, when my mother and I came to school, the vice principal told my mother that I had come to that school walking too tall and holding my head a little too high, and the other students resented it. Therefore, what could I expect? That was really what moved me forward to help Mr. Harada. It was the memory of that pain, not the physical pain, but I think I describe it as the pain of knowing what it is to be exiled from the human heart, to be set upon, to be innocent, and to be surrounded by people who don't care, who have banished you, exiled you.
But you also knew what it was like to be a part of a small mob attacking somebody else. When were you the attacker?
In the United States Marine Corps during boot camp, there was a private named Ledoux who we termed a non-hacker, who the drill instructors termed a non-hacker. He fell out of the runs in the morning. He didn't shine his brass or his boots very well. His personal hygiene was lacking. And when he would screw up, we would all be punished. So one night we rose 3 or 4 in the morning, threw blankets over him, and began beating him. I, too, fell out of the morning run. It took me a good while to learn to shine my shoes, but I was a coward who was trying to become a man and a hero by being a Marine in the first place. I didn't dislike LaRue, but I didn't have the courage to stop and not participate and to tell others not to participate. So lest I be found out that I perhaps was a non-hacker, that I wasn't really one of the few, the proud. I willingly joined others in this violent action that drove this young recruit to attempt suicide the following day.
So these are some of the reasons why you intervened, because you felt you had some kind of understanding about rage, about violence, about being attacked, about being an attacker.
Yes.
You were asked to testify at the Reginald Denny trial. What was your function in the trial?
Well, Takao doesn't remember anything, so I'm sort of his memory of the incident. So I was there to corroborate what had happened to him. I had told the prosecutors that I didn't remember any faces, so I couldn't make any IDs of anyone. What I really suspect is that they were playing a good nigger, bad nigger game.
Meaning?
They knew that I would come in a suit and a tie out of respect for the court, and that my hair would be trimmed, and that I wasn't wearing a beard at that time. And that what they would do is they would say, you see, this fellow helped people, and he's black. This fellow seems conservative and reasonable. But look at these fellows here. They're bad people. So we're not racist by heaping these charges on all of these charges on these fellows, and charges that we probably can't prove. You know what I mean? We're really being fair here. And I think that I was really part of that routine.
Were the questions you were asked that you found offensive on either side?
I didn't find any of the questions offensive. I'm not sure that I found the strategy offensive. I'm simply saying that I understand the nature of the strategy, which was one reason why I wrote A Gathering of Heroes, because I thought it was very important that I make it very clear that if indeed I am a good nigger today, it didn't happen in an instant, that it's been a process, that indeed there was a time when I would have been among those who were attacking people at the intersection of Florence and Normandy. So the question is, how did this happen?
Now, how seriously do you think that at some time in your life you would have been one of the people attacking others?
There's no doubt in my mind. I did it once. I did it in the Marine Corps. Why wouldn't I do it again? I mean, there have been times in my life when I was so enraged at white people in general, that violence was not far from my mind. And if any white person gave me any excuse, any reason, any invitation to violence, I was ready to go. It has happened on more than one occasion. Even occasionally now, a look, a word at the wrong time, even so far as attentiveness. I have a problem very often with white people feeling that I'm accessible to them. Sometimes I feel that white folks just talk to black folks that they don't know just because they feel that black folks are accessible. And there are times when I say to myself, why is it that this white person thinks that I am so accessible to them? They can just begin speaking to me and engage me in a conversation. Would they do the same thing to a white person? Do they feel that I am less than they are? So I can just sort of, they can engage me however they choose to engage me. It's very sick, and I have to guard against it. But even now, though it doesn't turn to violence, there is violence inside of me.
Explain more about this feeling people assume you're accessible. White people assume you're accessible because you're black. Explain that to me.
There are times when, for example, on public transportation, and on public transportation, we all know that you look at the signs and you don't look at each other and you don't talk to people that you don't know. And so you're standing there and this white guy starts to talk to you about not really intimate things, but sort of personal things. And you say, my goodness, what is it about me that makes you think that you can break the rule of anonymity and silence on this train? And it may simply be because you have a friendly face for very positive reasons. But sometimes my old thinking says to me, oh, he wouldn't speak to a white person because he respects them enough to respect their walls, their parameters.
If you had the chance to, like, actually talk to the people who were attacking the people who you saved, what would you want to say to them?
Those who have been convicted, I would say, don't you see? The truth is, Reginald Denny, Takao Harata, and so many others are about to sue the city for millions of dollars. As they say in the neighborhood, they gonna get paid. You sitting in the jail where so many have gone before. You tell me about the unfairness of the criminal justice system, and indeed, I understand that. But what role have you played in your own banishment? Did you relinquish control over your life by your action? And we can talk all day about poverty and not having a daddy at home and all of that sort of thing. But you may not be responsible for the problem, but you must be responsible for the solution, because it is your death and your exile that we're dealing with here.
My guest is actor Gregory Allen Williams. His new memoir, A Gathering of Heroes, is about how and why he rescued two people during the L.A. riots. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gregory Allen Williams. Does this whole experience of having rescued a couple of people during the rioting and having to testify at the Reginald Denny trial, becoming pretty well known, at least in Los Angeles, for what you did, has that like set you on a different course in any way?
Frighteningly so. It has. For a long time, as being a theater actor for many years and working in Chicago and Minneapolis, and then getting a few films and finally getting a television series, I thought, oh, this is going to do me. You know, this is going to do it. And I find that that fantasy is so unfulfilling. And along the way, I've always dealt in the real world, primarily with my writing. And I found that now, you know, people say, well, will you come and talk to us about your actions at Florence and Normandy and about your feelings. And so on one hand, people are calling me and asking me to come and pretend to be someone else as an actor. And then people are asking me to come and to share and to learn as Gregory. The two right now are in conflict. I've had to turn down many acting jobs. My agent has dumped me. People are saying, what are you doing? L.A. Law wants to check you, just checking your availability. Why are you in this high school in Harlem? You know, and there are moments when I have to ask myself that question. But as much as I love being an actor and as much as that brings me, I have to do something with it. And so when I go into a school and 10th or 11th graders say, oh, you're the man from Baywatch. And they listen to me for 60 seconds because of that. And within that 60 seconds, they're judging whether or not we have something to talk about. And if I do, now we've got a dialogue. Now we can talk about real things. And what happens most often is when we're done after an hour and a half, 2 hours, there are no questions about Baywatch. Now we're talking about issues of violence, issues of survival, compassion, justice, and liberty. That, ultimately, is much more rewarding than playing a make-believe character, I don't care how redeeming, on television. And that certainly affects my career and certainly affects my bank account. But, you know, that's what time it is.
I'll confess that I haven't seen Baywatch because it's on in the day and they don't let me watch TV during the day. but I know it's real popular. And isn't it like an afternoon soap with a lot of babes on it?
In some places it airs in prime time.
Oh, really?
In the evening.
Oh.
It is. It's Southern California lifeguards on the beach. I play a police officer. And I tell you, it's a funny thing because even in the industry, People want me to be ashamed of it. My agent says, don't put it on your resume. Don't put it on your reel. The other day we got a call from a producer wanted me to come to audition, wanted me to send a reel of my work. And he said, but don't put any Baywatch on it because it's babes on the beach. Well, I'm not a babe on the beach. And they certainly didn't hire me for my breast or my buns. I am on that show an acting anchor. And my work is good, and the writers write good stuff for me. And there have been times when I did hide my Baywatch involvement, but I don't anymore because I have nothing to be ashamed of, and my work is quality work. And
you're a cop on the show.
Yeah, and it takes a lot. You know, I get up sometimes at 5, 6 in the morning, and I get to go to the beach, and I'm out on the beach in the morning at 6 a.m., and the gulls are flying, and it's beautiful. You know, and then I'm in you know, New York, or I'm in Boston, and I'm in schools, and I'm listening to children tell me that they're going to be dead in 3 or 4 years because they've bought the statistics, you know, and these are children who are scholastically superior, telling me, well, you know, I'm going to be dead in 3 and 4 years, in 3 or 4 years. It's a good balance. And everybody's life needs balance. So I go on Baywatch and I do some light comedy and sometimes some drama. And I ride this little quad around and sometimes a horse, you know, and then I go out into the real world. And it helps me to do that.
Speaking of acting, you were in The Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. What part did you play in that?
I played a Secret Service agent whose name I have forgotten and probably most of the audience has. I spent 9 weeks on, matter of fact, I wrote most of the book on the set of In the Line of Fire. I would bring my word processor
every day. Oh,
wrote
most of your book, A Gathering of Heroes.
Yeah, between takes. And people would say, you bring that thing every day. What are you writing? And I'd say, well, I'm just catching up on my correspondence. Because, you know, when you're an actor in Hollywood, that's what you are. And you certainly don't tell anyone you're trying to write because then you open yourself up to smirks and, oh, there's an actor trying to write. They hired me as an actor. You know, and I would go and do my scenes, and I'd go back to my dressing room and, you know, work on the book and go home.
I want to ask you another question about race. I mean, I think a lot of African Americans feel, and I'm in no position to speak for African Americans being white, but I've certainly heard this expressed enough, and it's a sentiment I understand that other ethnic groups came here to get ahead. They were fleeing from something, whereas African Americans were brought here on slave ships. They didn't ask to come, and it's been, I mean, there's been just obstacles galore toward achieving any kind of success in the United States. And I think African Americans can legitimately say that they're just in a, they came here in a completely different context, and it's changed everything.
Yes, others brought their culture, they brought their language, they brought something to cling to. African Americans were stripped of their culture, stripped of their language. When people say things to me like, why don't you like those Vietnamese immigrants who came here only 10 years ago and now own restaurants and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? What have we had to battle against and continue to have to battle against, particularly ourselves? It is a miracle. It is amazing. There is so much more to do. But when you think about it, such a short time. My great-grandfather told my grandmother and her siblings, you can choose one of two names, Ross or Cockroth. The first man to own me was Ross. The last man to own me was Cockroth. I am a miracle. And this is a miracle. And there are many more miracles to be performed. So when people want to say, well, you black folks need to get it together, I say, back off. And then I turn around and I say to my African-American brothers and sisters, yeah, there's been some miracles, but now we've got to sort of turn inward and look and mourn. We have never mourned monuments to dead soldiers in Vietnam, the Second World War. Not one monument to the 5,800 African-American men who were drugged from their homes and beaten and burned between the late 1800s and the 1950s. We do not mourn. We have never mourned. Let us come together. Let us mourn and let us move forward. Let us face ourselves and face our own failings and stop looking outside of ourselves for all of our demons.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Gregory Allen Williams, his new memoir is called A Gathering of Heroes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a new novel about the after effects of slavery. We talk with writer Carol Phillips. His new novel, Crossing the River, is about the lives of three children whose African father sold them into slavery out of desperation after the crops failed. And filling in for film critic Stephen Schiff, Kevin Whitehead reviews I'll Do Anything. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson sparred with House Republicans today over the administration's new budget. He and other administration officials are promoting the budget today on Capitol Hill. The administration is claiming credit for the country's economic improvement. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Treasury Secretary kicked off several appearances today on Capitol Hill, testifying first before the House Budget Committee. Benson told the panel that only a year ago, economic recovery was fragile. Now, he says, due largely to passage of the deficit reduction package, the jobless recovery has turned into a job-creating recovery. Republicans refused to give credit to the president for the current economic situation and criticized the budget proposal for new spending. But Benson pointed out the elimination of 115 federal programs and hundreds of federal positions. The administration will have to walk a fine line on Capitol Hill. Fiscal conservatives within both parties are demanding still more in spending cuts, while other lawmakers want to protect certain programs and spend more on new initiatives. Benson described the process ahead as a creative tension between Congress and the president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Rain is pouring in the Los Angeles basin for a second day. It has snarled traffic on the earthquake-damaged freeways and sent mud coursing down hillsides. Rivers of mud closed 5 miles of the Pacific Coast Highway overnight. Authorities didn't fully reopen the major travel artery in time for morning rush hour. Some feeder roads to the highway were also closed. Sheriff's deputies tried to keep commuters from being turned back as they tried to motor through to the coast. The heavy rain has sloughed off the topsoil that was exposed after last year's wildfires. Florida law enforcement authorities have detained at least 60 Haitians in towns along the state's southeast coastline. 4 Haitians, including 2 children, drowned while attempting to come ashore. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
Officials say the Haitians came ashore in 2 separate locations. Authorities apprehended 25 Haitians in Palm Beach and detained 33 more Haitians about 40 miles away near Stewart. The Haitians have told conflicting stories about their arrival. Some say a boat let them off near the shore. Others say their boat broke into pieces. The Coast Guard found the remnants of a blue 25-foot boat off Palm Beach. However, a Coast Guard spokesman says that boat was not used by the Haitians. Authorities suspect that the Haitians were smuggled ashore, most likely from the Bahamas. Smuggling from the Bahamas has increased in recent months after the Bahamian government made it clear that Haitians are unwelcome because their presence helps to drag down the economy. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow fell just over a quarter point to end at 3,906. Advances edged declines. This is NPR. The U.S. Olympic Committee will meet next week in Oslo, Norway, to discuss skater Tanya Harding's case. They'll determine if she should stay on the Olympic team. Harding's attorneys have been told of the meeting. She will be asked to appear. There's no word on if Harding will testify. She's been implicated by her ex-husband in the plot to attack skater Nancy Kerrigan. But Harding has denied knowing anything about the plot before it happened. The Olympic Committee's executive director says the upcoming hearing will look into sportsmanship and fair play rather than guilt. Cosmonauts aboard the space station Mir today used a television hookup to send a good luck greeting to their Russian colleague who's flying on the space shuttle Discovery. Dave Pignanelli, a member station WMFE, reports.
Today was to be the day that crew members enjoyed the success of retrieving the Wakefield science satellite. Part of that task would have involved Sergei Krikalev, the first Russian to fly aboard a space shuttle. He was to operate the shuttle's mechanical arm and pull Wakefield back into Discovery's payload bay. That part of the mission was canceled yesterday by persistent technical problems with the satellite. This morning, Krikalev was given the opportunity to speak with his fellow countrymen aboard the Mir space station. A telephone hookup with Mir occurred when the crew appeared on ABC's Good Morning America. Yesterday, the crew spoke by radio with President Clinton, who hailed the mission as the first of what will become the norm of global cooperation in space. The crew is scheduled to return on Friday. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Food and Drug Administration has released new labeling rules for dairy products from cows that haven't been treated with a growth hormone. The FDA's guidelines say cheese, milk, and other dairy label guidelines can say they are from cows not treated with the BST growth hormone. But the labels also have to say there's no significant difference in milk taken from treated and untreated cows. Some critics insist the hormone has risks that haven't been fully studied. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Carol Phillips has written about the African diaspora from different perspectives. His new novel, Crossing the River, tells the story of slavery through the eyes of the descendants of one man, an African father who has had to sell his children into slavery. The book was shortlisted for the English Literary Award, the Booker Prize. Phillips' previous novel, Cambridge, was set on a West Indies plantation. The Final Passage was about a West Indian couple that migrates to London. Phillips' collection of essays, The European Tribe, was about his reflections on his experiences as a black man traveling through Europe. Phillips was born in the West Indies and grew up in England. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of his new novel, Crossing the River. The opening is in the voice of an African father 250 years ago.
A desperate foolishness. The crops failed. I sold my children. I remember I led them, two boys and a girl, along weary paths until we reached the place where the mud flats are populated with crabs and gulls. I watched as they huddled together and stared up at the fort above which flew a foreign flag. In the distance stood the ship into whose keep I would soon condemn them. The man and his company were waiting to once again cross the bar. We watched a while and then approached. Three children only. I jettisoned them at this point, where the tributary stumbles and swims out in all directions to meet the sea. I soiled my hands with cold goods in exchange for their warm flesh. A shameful intercourse. I could feel their eyes upon me, wondering why.
Tell me why you wanted to start your book, to frame your book, with the agony and guilt of an African father who sells his children into slavery. I mean, I don't think we usually think about African families sharing in the responsibility for slavery.
Well, that's precisely why I wanted to start it with that. One of the spurs to writing the book, certainly, was to examine some of the paradoxes, some of the ironies, some of the facts about slavery which have been hitherto, I think, hidden beneath the received history, which is perpetrated in schools, in textbooks, on television. And, you know, the guilt of Africans, not just then, this father speaks in my novel from a historical perspective of about 250 years ago, but I think the residual and continuing guilty, difficult relationship that Africa has with the those of the African diaspora in the West is something that I'm very interested in.
The story that interested me the most in your novel, Crossing the River, is the first story about a freed slave who becomes a missionary, a Christian missionary, and is sent to Africa to missionize there. And then his former owner and adoptive father, who worries about him, goes in search of him. The story here is that the former slave joined something called the American Colonization Society, which had a policy of repatriating former slaves back to the west coast of Africa and sending them there as missionaries. What I found interesting is that, you know, you're creating a story here where an African who becomes a slave in America goes back to Africa, and Africa is at this point so foreign to him that he can't take the climate. He can't take the illnesses that go around there. Nearly the whole first shipload of former slaves die when they get to Africa of malaria.
Well, this that was actually very factual. That's exactly what happened when the United States began a policy in the early 19th century of trying to repatriate freed African slaves in an attempt to solve the problem, in inverted commas, of slavery. What actually did happen is our first boatload, nearly everybody did die of malaria. People were thoroughly underprepared for coping with the physical as well as the cultural and psychological impact of arriving on the west coast of Africa. What really spurred me to write that section of the novel, though, was during the period when I was initially beginning to conceive of this book, Liberia was ripped asunder with a terrible and bloody civil war, a civil war which really hasn't ended to this day. And one of the facts which caused this civil war to emerge in Liberia was the conflict which had been engendered in the bosom of that society by the policy of repatriating African people of African origin in America back. The society was split right up until the 1980s between those who considered themselves perhaps to be rather superior to the native Africans simply on the basis that they were the descendants of the slaves who'd gone back to Liberia in the early 19th century.
Why did you want to send the plantation owner, Nash's former owner and then adoptive father, why did you want to send him to Africa in search of Nash?
Well, I thought that one of the, again, great paradoxes of the slave trade was the degree to which we don't often read about the affection, the love, if you will, which was engendered between black and white on the plantations. I don't think you can put any group of people together, irrespective of their ethnic or socio-historical origin, put them together in a laboratory, which is, after all, what a plantation was, a social-economic laboratory, without the real humanity of these people coming to the fore, which, and humanity, obviously a deep part of humanity, is the capacity to love, the capacity to feel deep affection. I was interested in, you know, that relationship between a master and a former slave, which wasn't draped in, you know, in adjectives to do with exploitation and brutality. I was interested in somebody who felt so deeply for his former slave, in spite of what this slave was, or maybe because of what this slave was, so deeply for this character that he was prepared to risk his own life and his own health to follow him across the ocean.
Do you think that some people will perceive your novel as, excuse the expression, politically incorrect because you're trying to...
I hope so. I mean, I'm not a particular... I'm not a particular advocate of some of the more rigorous and, I think, slightly comical. I said it's not comical for those people who've lost their jobs or those people who feel they've been their discourse, if you like, is being policed. But some of the aspects of political correctness I find thoroughly absurd. One of the areas which I've been not accused of, but I mean people have whispered about, is this area called cultural appropriation, where a writer might write in the voice or the consciousness of somebody who is considered to be beyond their jurisdiction, i.e., in my case, writing in the voice or the consciousness of a white female or a white male or a black female. The logical extension of that type of reductive thought is, are we as writers supposed to merely write in the voice and the consciousness of people who look like us? I mean, surely, after all, it's the role of a writer to dare to imagine his or herself into the lives of other people, people who don't look like them.
Carol Phillips is my guest. His new novel about slavery is called Crossing the River. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Carol Phillips. You grew up in London, but you were born on an island in the West Indies that your parents were from. What do you know about how your family got to the West Indies?
Well, that sort of points a finger quite cunningly at an area which I feel very frustrated about. In the early 80s, or maybe 81, I'm not sure, the courthouse in St. Kitts burned to the ground, and with it went most of the island records.
Wow.
Now, I have a feeling that if that courthouse had not burned to the ground, I would have spent large parts of the last 10 years excavating the records there, not just for my own personal history and to trace my own personal journey through my family to that island, but I think for stories, for material that might become the germ of future work. As it is, it is quite frustrating because I'm not able to really trace back beyond my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother died only a few years ago, but she was somebody who I was able to sit down and talk to about her grandmother, who was a slave. But, you know, she was an old lady. Her memory was fading. So it's pretty much, I'm afraid, an area of darkness for me, my own personal journey across the water to St. Kitts.
How much did your parents care about whether they knew or not?
I think my parents were more concerned, to be honest, with fitting into British society. They were migrants from the Caribbean, like many other West Indians in the 50s and early 60s. They migrated to Britain for economic reasons, for social reasons. They wanted to get better jobs. They certainly wanted their children to have more of an opportunity growing up in a society which could offer them not only good secondary but also tertiary education in university and so on. So they tended, like a lot of immigrants, not to look over their shoulder.
Were there many black people where you were when you were growing up?
Not really. One of the determining factors in my childhood in England was race, but almost as great a determining factor in the way in which I interacted with the society and the way in which I perceived myself was class, because I grew up in the north of England. I grew up in London as well, but mainly in the north of England as a working class kid. And, you know, British society is so stratified that race obviously plays a part, but class really does play a huge role as well. And I went at 18 to Oxford University speaking with a pretty strong working class blue collar accent. And that was at least as much of a problem, in inverted commas, a problem for my peer group looking at me, as was the fact that I happen to be black as well.
Now, you've written that you didn't read a book by a black author until you came to the United States.
Which, no, I didn't.
You were already, in your early 20s or late teens?
I was 20. I came to the United States during my time as a student. I had one more year to go at college, and I came over here and basically traveled around on a Greyhound bus, much in the same manner as most students do. And it was only then that I picked up a book. It was Native Son by Richard Wright, and I was in California at the time. And what drew me to the book was not the name of Richard Wright. I'd never heard of him. What drew me to the book was a picture of a young black man's face on the cover, and I thought, this was a young black man who looked more or less my age, my generation, and I picked up the book and I began to read it. And I remember being shocked, being surprised, being elated, being slightly hurt. I mean, the latter feeling, the hurt, was a sense of resentment that I'd managed to grow up in England all these years and nobody had had the common sense to offer me a book that was written by a black author. I was studying English literature at Oxford, and not one of my tutors, nowhere on the syllabus, was there any hint, any indication that a black author had ever penned a book.
But you didn't know about any of the black authors on your own and independently try to seek them out?
No, no, I didn't. You know, I as I said, I grew up in a rather sort of traditional, blinkered way and went to a very traditional and blinkered university in which, you know, the idea of, you know, introducing somebody like Richard Wright or James Baldwin or Langston Hughes or V.S. Naipaul or Derek Walcott or any of these people into the syllabus was obviously something that had either never occurred to them or had struck them as being anathema. So I began to make these discoveries for myself as a result of having been in the United States.
So was that what made you think about becoming a writer?
Yeah, because it was, you know, I'd already had in my mind, to be honest, the idea that I'd like to do something in the arts, maybe something in theatre, maybe something in television. But I didn't have any example or any model of a person or a writer whom I might emulate, somebody who had perhaps tilled the soil before me and might make it easier for me to follow. And once I discovered Wright, and as a result of Wright, Baldwin and Ellison and Toni Morrison and the then contemporary writers, Alice Walker and so on, I began to realize that there was a whole fictional area in which black people played a full and active life, a determining role in some cases, and there was no reason why I shouldn't begin to perceive of myself as a potential writer.
When you first came to the United States, were you surprised at all of the, expectations that both white people and black people had of you as a black man or as a black man from England or a black man from England whose family was from the West Indies? did you find that there were a different set of expectations here?
I found that what happened was when people looked at me initially, they usually assumed I was an American, maybe because of the way in which I dressed or looked or whatever. I mean, certainly it wasn't possible, and it probably still isn't to this day possible. I don't wear a deer stalker or a monocle, so they don't see me as right. Particularly British. When I open my mouth, of course, then I think there's a different set of expectations.
Do you know what the differences are?
Well, I sometimes find that people begin to talk to me as if somehow I had no affinity whatsoever with an African-American, as if they talked to me as though I was Alistair Cook or something, and they were just able to explore the sort of cousin relationship between, I'm an American talking to you as a Briton about these African-Americans. They're a bit of a problem, but we get on with them. And, you know, I sometimes think, well, don't they understand that obviously I feel a deep affinity with African-Americans because, you know, we come out of the same historical boat, as it were, both literally and metaphorically.
Carol Phillips. His new novel is called Crossing the River. He directs the writing program at Amherst College one semester a year and divides the rest of his time between London and St. Kitts in the West Indies. This is Fresh Air. NATO is planning to meet tomorrow about what to do in Bosnia. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report from Anne Garrels about the policy that the Allies seem to be moving toward, issuing an ultimatum to Serbs to back away from Sarajevo. We'll also hear from a U.S. senator who wants the United States to stage airstrikes against the Serb positions. And we'll talk with the vice president of Bosnia, who says that his government, given a choice between humanitarian assistance and a lifting of the arms embargo, would prefer to be able to defend themselves without the arms embargo. Also, more news on the budget. What the Congressional Budget Office decided today about the impact on the deficit of the Clinton health plan.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Kevin Whitehead is pinch-hitting for film critic Stephen Schiff with a review of James L. Brooks' new film, I'll Do Anything, a comedy set in Hollywood. It stars Albert Brooks as a producer whose new movie is getting hacked up in the re-editing because it tested poorly with preview audiences. The rest of the cast includes Julie Kavner as an audience pollster, Nick Nolte as an unemployed actor, and 5-year-old Whitney Wright as his cute, bratty 6-year-old daughter. Here's Kevin's review.
It's no secret that the movie I'll Do Anything was shot as a musical, but that preview audiences hated the singing. So writer, director, producer James L. Brooks cut the songs and reshot some sequences to fill the gaps. No more musical. Now, any work of art should be judged on what it is, not what might have been, but I bring this up in the movie's defense. I'll Do Anything has problems, but it does not play like a musical with the songs hacked out. It doesn't have that outsized sensibility that made TV's Cop Rock such a turkey. Okay, there are a few telltale signs. Harry Shearer, an actor who can carry a tune, loiters in the background of a couple of scenes like he used to have something to do. And when Julie Kavner's character lists the series of drugs and vitamins she's on, Prozac, Xanax, A and B, she sounds like she's building up to a patter song. Hollywood movies often sell what they preach against, violence usually, so give I'll Do Anything credit for consistency. Its troubled history is built into its content. What happened to the original musical is pretty much what happens to the action movie within the movie, which gets shortened after every advance preview. The producer Albert Brooks plays stands in for the movie's real producer, James Brooks. Elsewhere, Albert Brooks has shown he's a great and fearless actor by never working to make you like him or his character. In I'll Do Anything, he does the reverse, gives dignity to a stock Hollywood weakling by never working to make you hate him. He knows the type too well to be too cruel.
You know, there are all different ways. Do you know Bertolucci never reads actors? Just looks at them, feels around a little bit, and then he decides. Doesn't read a word. Well, I also have a way. I like to interview first, then I like to read, maybe come back the next day, do it all over again. I'll call people up the actor's worked with. I'll check him out. If he's famous, I'll do an opinion survey to see if people like him. If he's not famous, I'll put him on tape, grab anybody I can find and show him the tape. That's the way I like to do it. I believe in screen tests. I believe in cutting people out if the dailies are bad. I believe in replacing people if the previews aren't there, because I don't make movies for theaters that serve cappuccino in the lobby. I make popcorn movies.
I love that growl he puts on. All this doubling of fiction and reality in a Hollywood setting may fairly remind you of The Player. I'll Do Anything builds on the brilliant switch in Robert Altman's picture, where the climax of the Bruce Willis movie within the movie stood in for the climax missing from The Player itself. A faked climax becomes a metaphor for the movies, right? At the tearjerk climax of I'll Do Anything, a kid actor in a TV show has to cry on cue, a scene which requires the child playing the actor to perform the same feat. It's self-conscious as hell, but it's still a tearjerker. I like that Hall of Mirrors stuff, and I begrudgingly admire the acting of the eerily self-possessed 5-year-old Whitney Wright. She gets to sing the only song left in the film. Nick Nolte is typically fine as her dad. Unfortunately, the movie takes its tone more from the sudsy reconciliation between estranged father and daughter, and less from the attraction-repulsion dance between Albert Brooks and Julie Kavner. They're funny and abrasive, but this is still a movie with a cute kid in it. One other thing. I think James Brooks missed a bet by not letting us hear Nick Nolte sing under the closing credits, if only to hear how he stacks up against Clint Eastwood in Paint Your Wagon. If you say you'll do anything, mean it.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic based in New York. He also reviews jazz for Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Ann Neville and Devin Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we welcome back one of the world's foremost war surgeons, Chris Yanu. He's just returned from stints in Burundi and Afghanistan with the Red Cross. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.